Ramblings is nonsense, but I couldn't. Not if people were really praying to the Sun Summoner. Not if they were expecting me to save them. I remembered the Darkling's dire words beneath the broken roof of the barn. The age of Gracia power is coming to an end. I thought of the Volcra, of the lives being lost on the Shadowfold. A divided Ravka won't survive the new age. I wasn't just failing the Darkling or Bagra or myself. I was failing all of Ravka. When Jenya came by the next morning, I told her about the Avarat's visit, but she didn't seem concerned by what he'd said or his strange behavior.
"He is creepy," she admitted, "but harmless."
"He is not harmless. You should have seen him. He looked completely mad."
"He's just a priest."
"But why was he even here?" Jenya shrugged.
"Maybe the king asked him to pray for you."
"I'm not staying here again tonight. I want to sleep in my room, with a door that locks." Jenya sniffed and looked around the spare infirmary.
"Well, that, at least, I can agree with. I wouldn't want to stay here either."
Then she peered at me.
"You look dreadful,"
she said with her usual tact.
"Why don't you let me fix you up a bit?"
"No. Just let me get rid of the dark circles."
"No," I said stubbornly.
"But I do need a favor."
"Should I get my kit?"
she asked eagerly. I scowled at her. "Not that kind of favor. A friend of mine was injured on the fold. I've written to him, but I'm not sure my letters are getting through." I felt my cheeks flush and hurried on. "Could you find out if he's okay and where he's been stationed? I don't know who else to ask. And since you're always at the Grand Palace, I thought you might be able to help."
"Of course, but... well, have you been checking the casualty lists?"
I nodded, a lump in my throat. Jenya left to find paper and pen so I could write down Mal's name for her. I sighed and rubbed my eyes. I didn't know what to make of Mal's silence. I checked the casualty lists every single week, my heart pounding, my stomach in knots, terrified that I would see his name. And each week I gave thanks to all the saints that Mal was safe and alive, even if he couldn't be bothered to write. Was that the truth of it? My heart gave a painful twist. Maybe Mal was glad I was gone, glad to be free of old friendships and obligations. Or maybe he's lying in a hospital bed somewhere and you're being a petty little brat, I chided myself. Jenya returned and I wrote out Mal's name, regiment, and unit number. She folded the paper and slipped it into the sleeve of her kefta. "Thanks," I said hoarsely.
"I'm sure he's fine," she said, and gave my hands a gentle squeeze. "Now lie back so I can fix those dark circles."
"Jenya!"
"Lie back, or you can forget about your little favor."
My jaw dropped. "You are rotten."
"I am marvelous."
I glared at her, then flopped back against the pillows. After Jenya left, I made arrangements to return to my own quarters. The healer wasn't happy about it, but I insisted. I was barely even sore anymore, and there was no way I was spending another night in that empty infirmary. When I got back to my room, I took a bath and tried to read one of my theory books. I couldn't concentrate. I was dreading returning to my classes the next day, dreading another futile lesson with Bagra. The stares and gossip about me had died down a bit since I arrived at the little palace, but I had no doubt that my fight with Zoya would bring that all back. As I rose and stretched, I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror above my dressing table. I crossed the room and scrutinized my face in the glass. The dark shadows beneath my eyes were gone, but I knew they would be back in a few days, and it made little difference. I looked the way I always had, tired, scrawny, sick. Nothing like a real Grisha. The power was there, somewhere inside me, but I couldn't reach it, and I didn't know why. Why was I different? Why had it taken so long for my power to reveal itself, and why couldn't I access it on my own? Reflected in the mirror, I could see the thick golden curtains at the windows, the brilliantly painted walls, the firelight glittering off the tiles in the grate. Zoya was awful, but she was also right.
I didn't belong in this beautiful world, and if I didn't find a way to use my power, I never would. Chapter 12. The next morning wasn't as bad as I'd expected. Zoya was already in the domed hall when I entered. She sat by herself at the end of the summoner's table, eating her breakfast in silence. She didn't look up as Maria and Nadia called their greetings to me, and I did my best to ignore her, too. I savored every step of my walk down to the lake. The sun was bright, the air cold on my cheeks, and I wasn't looking forward to the stuffy, windowless confines of Bagra's hut. But when I climbed the steps to her door, I heard raised voices. I hesitated and then knocked softly. The voices quieted abruptly, and after a moment, I pushed the door open and peeked inside. The Darkling was standing by Bagra's tile oven, his face furious. "Sorry," I said, and began to back out the door. But Bagra just snapped, "In, girl! Don't let the heat out!" When I entered and shut the door, the Darkling gave me a small bow.
"How are you, Alina?"
"I'm fine," I managed.
"She's fine," hooted Bagra. "She's fine. She cannot light a hallway, but she's fine."
I winced and wished I could disappear into my boots. To my surprise, the Darkling said,
"Leave her be."
Bagra's eyes narrowed.
"You'd like that, wouldn't you?"
The Darkling sighed and ran his hands through his dark hair in exasperation. When he looked at me, there was a rueful smile on his lips, and his hair was going every which way.
"Bagra has her own way of doing things," he said.
"Don't patronize me, boy!"
Her voice cracked out like a whip. To my amazement, I saw the Darkling stand up straighter and then scowl, as if he'd caught himself.
"Don't chide me, old woman," he said in a low, dangerous voice.
Angry energy crackled through the room. What had I walked into? I was thinking about slipping out the door and leaving them to finish whatever argument I'd interrupted when Bagra's voice lashed out again.
"The boy thinks to get you an amplifier," she said. "What do you think of that, girl?"
It was so strange to hear the Darkling called boy that it took me a moment to understand her meaning. But when I did, hope and relief rushed through me. An amplifier. Why hadn't I thought of it before? Why hadn't they thought of it before? Bagra and the Darkling were able to help me call my power because they were living amplifiers. So why not an amplifier of my own, like Ivan's bear claws or the seal tooth I'd seen hanging around Marie's neck?
"I think it's brilliant,"
I exclaimed more loudly than I'd intended. Bagra made a disgusted sound. The Darkling gave her a sharp glance, but then he turned to me.
"Alina, have you ever heard of Muratsova's herd?"
"Of course she has. She's also heard of unicorns and the Shuhan dragons," Bagra said mockingly.
An angry look passed over the Darkling's features, but then he seemed to master himself.
"May I have a word with you, Alina?" he inquired politely.
Of course, I stammered. Bagra snorted again, but the Darkling ignored her and took me by the elbow to lead me out of the cottage, shutting the door firmly behind us. When we had walked a short distance down the path, he heaved a huge sigh and ran his hands through his hair again.
"That woman," he muttered.
It was hard not to laugh.
"What?"
he said warily. "I've just never seen you so ruffled."
"Bagra has that effect on people."
"Was she your teacher, too?" A shadow crossed his face.
"Yes," he said. "So what do you know about Muratsova's herd?"
I bit my lip. "Just, well, you know." He sighed.
"Just children's stories."
I shrugged apologetically.
"It's all right," he said. "What do you remember from the stories?"
I thought back, remembering Anakuya's voice in the dormitories late at night. They were white deer, magical creatures that appeared only at twilight.
"They're no more magical than we are, but they are ancient and very powerful."
They're real? I asked incredulously. I didn't mention that I certainly hadn't been feeling very magical or powerful lately.
I think so.
But Bagra doesn't?
She usually finds my ideas ridiculous. What else do you remember?
Well, I said with a laugh, in Anakuya's stories, they could talk, and if a hunter captured them and spared their lives, they granted wishes. He laughed then. It was the first time I'd ever heard his laugh, a lovely dark sound that rippled through the air.
Well, that part definitely isn't true.
But the rest is?
Kings and darklings have been searching for Muratsova's herd for centuries. My hunters claim they've seen signs of them, though they've never seen the creatures themselves.
And you believe them? His slate-colored gaze was cool and steady.
My men don't lie to me.
I felt a chill skitter up my spine. Knowing what the darkling could do, I wouldn't be keen on lying to him either. All right, I said uneasily.
If Morozova's stag can be taken, its antlers can be made into an amplifier.
He reached out and tapped my collarbone. Even that brief contact was enough to send a jolt of surety through me. A necklace, I asked, trying to picture it, still feeling the tap of his finger at the base of my throat. He nodded.
The most powerful amplifier ever known.
My jaw dropped. And you want to give it to me? He nodded again. Wouldn't it just be easier for me to get a claw or a fang or, I don't know, pretty much anything else? He shook his head.
If we have any hope of destroying the fold, we need the stag's power.
But maybe if I had one to practice with.
You know it doesn't work that way.
I do? He frowned.
Haven't you been reading your theory?
I gave him a look and said, there's a lot of theory. He surprised me by smiling.
I forget you're new to this.
Well, I don't, I muttered.
Is it that bad?
To my embarrassment, I felt a lump well up in my throat. I swallowed it down. Bagra must have told you I can't summon a single sunbeam on my own.
It will happen, Alina. I'm not worried.
You're not?
No. And even if I were, once we have the stag, it won't matter.
I felt a surge of frustration. If an amplifier could make it possible for me to be a real Grisha, then I didn't want to wait for some mythical antler. I wanted a real one, now. If no one's found Morozova's herd in all this time, what makes you think you'll find it now? I asked.
Because this was meant to be. The stag was meant for you, Alina. I can feel it.
He looked at me. His hair was still a mess, and in the bright morning sunlight he looked more handsome and more human than I'd ever seen him.
I guess I'm asking you to trust me,
he said. What was I supposed to say? I didn't really have a choice. If the Darkling wanted me to be patient, I would have to be patient. Okay, I said finally. But hurry it up. He laughed again, and I felt a pleased flush creep up my cheeks. Then his expression became serious.
I've been waiting for you a long time, Alina, he said. You and I are going to change the world.
I laughed nervously. I'm not the world-changing type.
Just wait,
he said softly. And when he looked at me with those gray quartz eyes, my heart gave a little thump. I thought he was going to say something more, but abruptly he stepped back, a troubled look on his face.
Good luck with your lessons,
he said. He gave me a short bow and turned on his heel to walk up the path to the lake shore. But he'd only gone a few steps before he turned back to me.
Alina, he said. About the stag.
Yes?
Please keep it to yourself. Most people think it's just a children's story. And I'd hate to look a fool.
I won't say anything, I promised. He nodded once, and without another word strode away. I stared after him. I felt a little dazed, and I wasn't sure why.
When I looked up, Bagra was standing on the porch of her cottage watching me. For no reason at all, I blushed.
"Humph,"
she snorted. And then she turned her back on me, too. After my conversation with the Darkling, I took my first opportunity to visit the library. There was no mention of the SAG in any of my theory books, but I did find a reference to Ilya Murotsova, one of the first and most powerful Grisha. There was also plenty about amplifiers. The books were very clear on the fact that a Grisha could have only one amplifier in his or her lifetime, and that once a Grisha owned an amplifier, it could be possessed by no one else. The Grisha claims the amplifier, but the amplifier claims the Grisha as well. Once it is done, there can be no other. Like calls to like, and the bond is made. The reason for this wasn't entirely clear to me, but it seemed to have something to do with a check on Grisha power. The horse has speed, the bear has strength, the bird has wings. No creature has all of these gifts, and so the world is held in balance. Amplifiers are a part of this balance, not a means of subverting it. And each Grisha would do well to remember this, or risk the consequences. Another philosopher wrote, "Why can a Grisha possess but one amplifier? I will answer this question instead. What is infinite? The universe and the greed of men." Sitting beneath the library's glass dome, I thought of the Black Heretic. The Darkling had said that the Shadow Fault was the result of his ancestors' greed. Was that what the philosophers meant by consequences? For the first time it occurred to me that the Fold was the one place where the Darkling was helpless, where his powers meant nothing. The Black Heretic's descendants had suffered for his ambition. Still, I couldn't think but help that it was Ravka that had been made to pay in blood. Fall turned to winter, and cold winds stripped the branches of the palace gardens bare. Our table was still laden with fresh fruit and flowers furnished from the Grisha hothouses, where they made their own weather. But even juicy plums and purple grapes did little to improve my appetite. Somehow I thought that my conversation with the Darkling might change something in me. I wanted to believe the things he'd said, and standing by the lake shore, I almost had. But nothing changed. I still couldn't summon without Bagra's help. I still wasn't truly a Grisha. All the same, I felt a bit less miserable about it. The Darkling had asked me to trust him, and if he believed that the stag was the answer, then all I could do was hope he was right. I still avoided practicing with the other summoners, but I let Marie and Nadia drag me to the Banya a couple of times, and to one of the ballets at the Grand Palace. I even let Jenya put a little color in my cheeks. My new attitude infuriated Bagra.
"You're not even trying anymore," she shouted. "You're waiting for some magical deer to come save you? For your pretty necklace? You might as well wait for a unicorn to put its head in your lap, you stupid thing."
When she started railing at me, I just shrugged. She was right. I was tired of trying and failing. I wasn't like the other Grisha, and it was time I accepted that. Besides, some rebellious part of me enjoyed driving her into a tizzy. I didn't know what punishment Zoya had received, but she continued to ignore me. She'd been barred from the training rooms, and I'd heard she would be returning to Krybirsk after the winter fate. Occasionally, I caught her glaring at me or giggling behind her hand with her little group of summoner friends, but I tried not to let it get to me. Still, I couldn't shake the sense of my own failure. When the first snow came, I woke to find a new kefta waiting for me on my door. It was made of heavy midnight blue wool, and had a hood lined with thick golden fur. I put it on, but it was hard not to feel like a fraud. After picking at my breakfast, I made the familiar walk to Bagra's cottage. The gravel paths, cleared of snow by Inferni, sparkled beneath the weak winter sun. I was almost all the way to the lake when a servant caught up with me. She handed me a folded piece of paper and bobbed a curtsy before scurrying back up the path. I recognized Jenya's handwriting. "Malyen Oretsev's unit has been stationed at the Chernast outpost in northern Sabaea for 6 weeks,"
He is listed as healthy. You can write to him, care of his regiment. The Kirch ambassadors are showering the queen with gifts. Oysters and sandpipers packed in dry ice, vial, and almond candies. I'll bring some by tonight. G. Mal was in Sabaea. He was safe, alive, far from the fighting, probably hunting winter game. I should be grateful. I should be glad. You can write to him, care of his regiment. I'd been writing to him, care of his regiment, for months. I thought of the last letter I'd sent. Dear Mal, I'd written. I haven't heard from you, so I assume you've met and married a Volkra, and that you're living comfortably on the Shadow Fold, where neither of you have light nor paper with which to write. Or possibly, your new bride ate both your hands. I filled the letter with descriptions of Botkin, the queen's snuffling dog, and the Grisha's curious fascination with peasant customs. I'd told him about beautiful Genya and the pavilions by the lake and the marvelous glass dome in the library. I told him about mysterious Bagra and the orchids in the hothouse and the birds painted above my bed. But I hadn't told him about Muratsova's stag, or the fact that I was such a disaster as a Grisha, or that I still missed him every single day. When I was done, I'd hesitated and then hastily scrawled at the bottom, "I don't know if you got my other letters. This place is more beautiful than I can describe, but I would trade it all to spend an afternoon skipping stones with you at Drivka's pond. Please write." But he had gotten my letters. What had he done with all of them? Had he even bothered to open them? Had he sighed with embarrassment when the 5th and the 6th and the 7th arrived? I cringed. "Please write, Mal. Please don't forget me, Mal." Pathetic, I thought, brushing angry tears away. I stared out at the lake. It was starting to freeze. I thought of the creek that ran through Duke Karamzov's estate. Every winter, Mal and I had waited for that creek to freeze, so we could skate on it. I crumpled Jenya's note in my fist. I didn't want to think about Mal anymore. I wished I could blot out every memory of Karamsin. Mostly I wished I could run back to my room and have a good cry. But I couldn't. I had to spend another pointless, miserable morning with Bagra. I took my time walking my way down the lake path, then stomped up the steps to Bagra's hut and banged open the door. As usual, she was sitting by the fire, warming her bony body by the flames. I plunked myself down in the chair opposite her and waited. Bagra let out a short bark of laughter. "So you're angry today, girl? What do you have to be angry about? Are you sick of waiting for your magical white deer?" I crossed my arms and said nothing. "Speak up, girl." On any other day, I would have lied, told her I was fine, said that I was tired. But I guess I'd reached my breaking point because I snapped. "I'm sick of all this," I said angrily. "I'm sick of eating rye and herring for breakfast. I'm sick of wearing this stupid kefta. I'm sick of being pummeled by Botkin, and I'm sick of you." I thought she would be furious, but instead she just peered at me. With her head cocked to one side and her eyes glittering black in the firelight, she looked like a very mean sparrow. "No," she said slowly. "No, it's not that. There's something else." "What is it?" "Is the poor little girl homesick?" I snorted. "Homesick for what?" "You tell me, girl. What's so bad about your life here? New clothes, a soft bed, hot food at every meal, the chance to be the darkling's pet."
"I'm not his pet."
"But you want to be," she jeered. "Don't bother lying to me. You're like all the rest. I saw the way you looked at him."
My cheeks burned, and I thought about hitting Bagra over the head with her own stick.
"A 1,000 girls would sell their own mothers to be in your shoes, and yet here you are, miserable and sulking like a child. So tell me, girl, what is your sad little heart pining for?"
She was right, of course. I knew very well that I was homesick for my best friend, but I wasn't about to tell her that. I stood up, knocking my chair back with a clatter. This is a waste of time.
Is it? What else do you have to do with your days? Make maps? Fetch inks for some old cartographer?
There's nothing wrong with being a map maker.
Of course not, and there's nothing wrong with being a lizard either. Unless you were born to be a hawk.
I've had enough of this, I snarled, and turned my back on her. I was close to tears, and I refused to cry in front of this spiteful old woman.
Where are you going? She called after me, her voice mocking. What's waiting for you out there?
Nothing, I shouted at her. No one. As soon as I said it, the truth of the words hit me so hard that it left me breathless. I gripped the door handle, feeling suddenly dizzy. In that moment, the memory of the Grisha examiners came rushing back to me. I am in the sitting room at Kerimsen. A fire is burning in the grate. The heavy-set man in blue has hold of me, and he is pulling me away from Mal. I feel Mal's finger slip as his hand is torn from mine. The young man in purple picks Mal up and drags him into the library, slamming the door behind him. I kick and thrash. I can hear Mal shouting my name. The other man holds me. The woman in red slides her hand around my wrist. I feel a sudden rush of pure certainty wash over me. I stop struggling. A call rings through me. Something within me rises up to answer. I can't breathe. It's like I'm kicking up from the bottom of a lake about to break the surface, my lungs aching for air. The woman in red watches me closely, her eyes narrowed. I hear Mal's voice through the library door. Alina, Alina. I know then. I know that we are different from one another. Terribly, irrevocably different. Alina, Alina. I make my choice. I grab hold of the thing inside me and push it back down.
Mal!
I shout, and I begin to struggle once more. The woman in red tries to keep hold of my wrist, but I wriggle and wail until finally she lets me go. I leaned against the door to Bagra's hut, trembling. The woman in red had been an amplifier. That was why the Darkling's call had felt familiar. But somehow I'd managed to resist her. At last I understood. Before Mal, Kerimsen had been a place of terrors. Long nights spent crying in the dark, older children who ignored me, cold and empty rooms. But then Mal arrived, and all of that changed. The dark hallways became places to hide and play. The lonely woods became places to explore. Kerimsen became our place, our kingdom, and I wasn't afraid anymore. But the Grisha examiners would have taken me from Kerimsen. They would have taken me away from Mal, and he had been the only good thing in my world. So I'd made my choice. I pushed my power down and held it there each day with all my energy and will, without ever realizing it. I'd used up every bit of myself to keep that secret. I remember standing at the window with Mal, watching the Grisha depart in their troika. How tired I'd felt. The next morning, I'd woken to find dark circles beneath my eyes. They'd been with me ever since. And now? I asked myself, pressing my forehead against the cool wood of the door, my whole body shaking. Now Mal had left me behind. The only person in the world who truly knew me had decided I wasn't worth the effort of a few words. But I was holding on still. Despite all the luxuries of the little palace, despite my newfound powers, despite Mal's silence, I held on. Bagra was right. I thought I was making such an effort. But deep down, some part of me just wanted to go home to Mal. Some part of me hoped that this had all been a mistake, that the Darkling would realize his error and send me back to the regiment, that Mal would realize how much he'd missed me, that we'd grow old together in our meadow. Mal had moved on. But I was still standing frightened before those three mysterious figures, holding tight to his hand. It was time to let go. That day on the Shadowfold, Mal had saved my life and I had saved his. Maybe that was meant to be the end of us. The thought filled me with grief, grief for the dreams we'd shared, for the love I'd felt, for the hopeful girl I would never be again. That grief flooded through me, dissolving a knot that I hadn't even known was there. I closed my eyes, feeling tears slide down my cheeks, and I reached out to the thing within me that I'd kept hidden for so long. "I'm sorry," I whispered to it. "I'm sorry I left you so long in the dark. I'm sorry, but I'm ready now." I called, and the light answered. I felt it rushing toward me from every direction, skimming over the lake, skittering over the golden domes of the little palace, under the door and through the walls of Bagra's cottage. I felt it everywhere. I opened my hands and the light bloomed right through me, filling the room, illuminating the stone walls, the old tile oven, and every angle of Bagra's strange face. It surrounded me, blazing with heat, more powerful and more pure than ever before because it was all mine. I wanted to laugh, to sing, to shout. At last there was something that belonged wholly and completely to me.
"Good," said Bagra, squinting in the sunlight. "Now we work."
Chapter 13. That very afternoon, I joined the other Aetherialci by the lake and called my power for them for the first time. I sent a sheet of light shimmering out over the water, letting it roll over the waves that Evo had summoned. I didn't have the others' control yet, but I managed. In fact, it was easy. Suddenly lots of things seemed easy. I wasn't tired all the time or winded when I climbed up the stairs. I slept deeply and dreamlessly every night and woke refreshed. Food was a revelation. Bowls of porridge heaped with sugar and cream, plates of skate fried in butter, fat plums and hothouse peaches, the clear and bitter taste of kvass. It was as if that moment in Bagra's cottage was my first full breath, and I had awakened into a new life. Since none of the other Grisha knew that I'd had so much trouble summoning, they were all a little baffled by the change in me. I didn't offer any explanations, and Jenya let me in on some of the more hilarious rumors. "Marie and Ivo were speculating that the Fjerdins had infected you with some disease."
"I thought Grisha didn't get sick."
"Exactly," she said. "That's why it was so very sinister. But apparently the Darkling cured you by feeding you his own blood and an extract of diamonds."
"That's disgusting," I said, laughing.
"Oh, that's nothing. Zoya actually tried to put it around that you were possessed."
I laughed even harder. My lessons with Bagra were still difficult, and I never actually enjoyed them, but I did relish any chance to use my power, and I felt like I was making progress. At first I'd been frightened every time I got ready to call the light, afraid that it just wouldn't be there, and I'd be back to where I started.
"It isn't something separate from you," Bagra snapped. "It isn't an animal that shies away from you or chooses whether or not to come when you call it. Do you ask your heart to beat or your lungs to breathe? Your power serves you because that is its purpose, because it cannot help but serve you."
Sometimes I felt like there was a shadow in Bagra's words, a second meaning she wanted me to understand, but the work I was doing was hard enough without guessing at the secrets of a bitter old woman. She drove me hard, pushing me to expand my reach and my control. She taught me to focus my power in short, bright bursts, piercing beams that burned with heat, and long, sustained cascades. She forced me to call the light again and again and again, until I barely had to reach for it. She made me trek to her cottage at night to practice when it was nearly impossible for me to find any light to summon. When I finally, proudly produced a weak thread of light, she slammed her cane down on the ground and shouted, "Not good enough!" "I'm doing my best," I muttered in exasperation.
"Pah," she spat. "Do you think the world cares if you do your best? Do it again and do it right."
My lessons with Botkin were the real surprise. As a little girl, I had run and played with Mal in the woods and fields, but I'd never been able to keep up with him. I'd always been too sickly and frail, too easy to tire. But as I ate and slept regularly for the first time in my life, all of that changed. Botkin put me through brutal combat drills and seemingly endless runs through the palace grounds, but I found myself enjoying some of the challenges. I liked learning what this new, stronger body could do. I doubted I'd ever be able to outspar the old mercenary, but the fabricators had helped even the field. They'd produced a pair of fingerless leather gloves for me that were lined with little mirrors. The mysterious glass discs David had shown me on that first day into the workshops. With a flick of the wrist, I could slide a mirror between my fingers and, with Botkin's permission, I practiced bouncing flashes of light off them and into my opponent's eyes. I worked with them until they felt almost natural in my hands, like extensions of my own fingers. Botkin was still gruff and critical and took every opportunity to call me useless, but once in a while,
I thought I glimpsed a hint of approval on his weathered features.
Late in winter, he took me aside after a long lesson in which I'd actually managed to land a blow to his ribs and been thanked for it with a hard cuff across my jaw.
"Here,"
he said, handing me a heavy knife in a steel and leather sheath.
"Always keep with you."
With a jolt, I saw that it was no ordinary knife. It was gracious steel. "Thank you," I managed.
"Not thank you," he said.
He tapped the ugly scar at his throat.
"Steel is earned."
Winter looked different to me than it ever had before. I spent sunny afternoons skating on the lake or sledding on the palace grounds with the other summoners. Snowy evenings were spent in the domed hall, gathered around the tile ovens, drinking kvass and gorging ourselves on sweets. We celebrated the feast of Sankt Nikolai with huge bowls of dumpling soup and kutia made with honey and poppy seeds. Some of the other Gracia left the palace to go on sleigh rides and dog sledding excursions in the snow-blanketed countryside surrounding Olds Alta, but for security reasons, I was still confined to the palace grounds. I didn't mind. I felt more comfortable with the summoners now, but I doubted I'd ever really enjoy being around Marie and Nadia. I was much happier sitting in my room with Jenya, drinking tea and gossiping by the fire. I loved to hear all the court gossip, and even better were the tales of the opulent parties at the Grand Palace. My favorite was the story of the massive pie that the Count had presented to the King, and the dwarf who had burst out of it to hand the Tsaritsa a bouquet of forget-me-nots. At the end of the season, the King and Queen would host a final winter fete that all the Gracia would attend. Jenya claimed it would be the most lavish party of all. Every noble family and high court officer would be there, along with military heroes, foreign dignitaries, and the Tsarevich, the king's eldest son and heir to the throne. I'd once seen the crown prince riding around the palace grounds on a white gelding that was roughly the size of a house. He was almost handsome, but he had the king's weak chin and eyes so heavy-lidded that it was hard to tell if he was tired or just supremely bored.
"Probably drunk," said Jenya, stirring her tea. "He devotes all his time to hunting horses and imbibing. Drives the queen mad. Well, Ravka is at war. He should probably be more concerned with matters of state."
"Oh, she doesn't care about that. She just wants him to find a bride instead of gallivanting around the world spending mounds of gold buying up ponies."
"What about the other one?" I asked.
I knew the king and queen had a younger son, but I'd never actually seen him.
"Sobotchka?"
"You can't call a royal prince puppy," I laughed.
"That's what everyone calls him."
She lowered her voice.
"And there are rumors that he isn't strictly royal."
I nearly choked on my tea.
"No. Only the queen knows for sure. He's a bit of a black sheep anyway. He insisted on doing his military service in the infantry. Then he apprenticed to a gunsmith."
"And he's never at court?"
"Not in years. I think he's off studying shipbuilding or something equally dull."
"He'd probably get along well with David," she added sourly. "What do you two talk about anyway?" I asked curiously. I still didn't quite understand Jenya's fascination with the fabricator.
She sighed. "The usual. Life, love,
The melting point of iron ore. She wound a curl of bright red hair around her finger, and her cheeks flushed a pretty pink.
He's actually quite funny when he lets himself be.
Really? Jenya shrugged.
I think so.
I patted her hand reassuringly.
He'll come around. He's just shy.
Maybe I should lie down on a table in the workroom and wait to see if he welds something to me. I think that's the way most great love stories begin. She laughed, and I felt a sudden niggle of guilt. Jenya talked so easily about David, but I'd never confided in her about Mal.
That's because there's nothing to confide,
I reminded myself harshly, and added more sugar to my tea. One quiet afternoon, when the other Grisha had ventured out of Osalta, Jenny convinced me to sneak into the Grand Palace, and we spent hours looking through the clothes and shoes in the Queen's dressing room. Jenya insisted that I try on a pale pink silk gown studded with river pearls, and when she laced me up in it and stuck me in front of one of the giant golden mirrors, I had to look twice. I'd learned to avoid mirrors. They never seemed to show me what I wanted to see. But the girl standing next to Jenya in the glass was a stranger. She had rosy cheeks and shiny hair and a shape. I could have stared at her for hours. I suddenly wished good old Mikhail could see me. Sticks indeed, I thought smugly. Jenya caught my eye in the mirror and grinned. Is this why you dragged me in here? I asked suspiciously.
Whatever do you mean?
You know what I mean.
I just thought you might want to get a good look at yourself, that's all.
I swallowed the embarrassing lump in my throat and gave her an impulsive hug.
Thanks,
I whispered. Then I gave her a little shove. Now get out of the way. It's impossible to feel pretty with you standing next to me. We spent the rest of the afternoon trying on dresses and goggling at ourselves in the mirror. Two activities I never would have expected to enjoy. We lost track of time, and Jenya had to help me scramble out of an aquamarine ball gown and back into my kefta, so that I could hurry down to the lake for my evening lesson with Bagra. I ran all the way, but I was still late, and she was furious. The evening sessions with Bagra were always the hardest, but she was particularly tough on me that night.
"Control!"
she snapped, as the weak wave of sunlight that I'd summoned flickered on the lake shore.
Where is your focus?
At dinner, I thought, but didn't say. Jenya and I had gotten so caught up in the distractions of the Queen's wardrobe that we'd forgotten to eat, and my stomach was growling. I centered myself, and the light bloomed brighter, reaching out over the frozen lake.
Better,
she said.
Let the light do the work for you. Like calls to like.
I tried to relax and let the light call to itself. To my surprise, it surged across the ice, illuminating the little island in the middle of the lake.
More, Bagra demanded. What's stopping you?
I dug deeper, and the circle of light swelled past the island, bathing the whole lake and the school on the opposite shore in gleaming sunlight. Though there was snow on the ground, the air around us shone bright and heavy with summer heat. My body thrummed with power. It was exhilarating. But I could feel myself tiring, bumping up against the limits of my abilities.
More! Bagra shouted. I can't! I protested. More!
She said again. And there was an urgency inside her voice that sounded an alarm inside of me and caused my focus to falter. The light wavered and slipped from my grasp. I scrambled for it, but it rushed away from me, plunging the school, then the island, and then the lake shore back into darkness.
It's not enough.
His voice made me jump. The darkling emerged from the shadows into the lamplit path.
It might be, said Bagra. You see how strong she is. I wasn't even helping her. Give her an amplifier and see what she can do.
The darkling shook his head.
She'll have the stag.
Bagra scowled.
You're a fool.
I've been called worse, often by you.
This is folly. You must reconsider.
The darkling's face went cold.
I must. You don't give me orders anymore, old woman. I know what has to be done.
I might surprise you, I piped up. The Darkling and Bagra turned to stare at me.
It was almost like they'd forgotten I was there.
Bagra's right. I know I can do better. I can work harder.
You've been on the Shadow Fold, Alina. You know what we're up against.
I felt suddenly stubborn. I know that I'm getting stronger every day. If you give me a chance.
Again, the Darkling shook his head. I can't take that kind of chance. Not with Ravka's future at stake.
I understand, I said numbly.
Do you?
Yes, I said. Without Moritzova's stag, I'm pretty much useless.
Ah, so she's not as stupid as she looks, cackled Bagra.
Leave us, said the Darkling with surprising ferocity.
We'll all suffer for your pride, boy.
I won't ask you again.
Bagra gave him a disgusted glower, then turned on her heel and marched back up the path to her cottage. When her door slammed shut, the Darkling regarded me in the lamplight.
You look well, he said.
Thanks, I mumbled, my eyes sliding away. Maybe Jenya could teach me to take a compliment.
If you're returning to the little palace, I'll walk you, he said.
For a while we strolled in silence along the lake shore, past the deserted stone pavilions. Across the ice, I could see the lights of the school. Finally, I had to ask, has there been any word of the stag? He pressed his lips together.
No, he said. My men think that the herd may have crossed into Fierda.
Oh, I said, trying to hide my disappointment. He stopped abruptly.
I don't think you are useless, Alina.
I know, I said to the tops of my boots. Not useless, just not exactly useful.
No Grisha is powerful enough to face the fold. Not even me.
I get it.
But you don't like it.
Should I? If I can't help you destroy the fold, then what exactly am I good for? Midnight picnics? Keeping your feet warm in the winter? His mouth quirked up in a half smile.
Midnight picnics?
I couldn't smile back. Bodkin told me that Grisha Steel is earned. It's not that I'm not grateful for all of this. I am, truly. But I don't feel like I've earned any of it. He sighed.
I'm sorry, Alina. I asked you to trust me, and I haven't delivered.
He looked so weary that I felt instantly contrite. It's not that.
It's true.
He took another deep breath and ran a hand over his neck.
Maybe Bagra's right, as much as I hate to admit it.
I cocked my head to one side. You never seem fazed by anything. Why do you let her bother you so much?
I don't know.
Well, I think she's good for you. He started in surprise.
Why?
Because she's the only one around here who isn't scared of you or constantly trying to impress you.
Are you trying to impress me?
Of course, I laughed.
Do you always say exactly what you're thinking?
Not even half the time. Then he laughed, too, and I remembered how much I liked the sound.
Then I guess I should count myself lucky, he said.
What's Bagra's power, anyway? I asked, the thought occurring to me for the first time. She was an amplifier like the Darkling, but he had his own power, too.
I'm not sure, he said. I think she was a tide maker. No one around here is old enough to remember.
He looked down at me. The cold air had put a flush in his cheeks, and the lamplight shone in his gray eyes.
Alina, if I tell you that I still believe we can find the stag, would you think I'm mad?
Why would you care what I think? He looked genuinely baffled.
I don't know, he said. But I do.
And then he kissed me. It happened so suddenly that I barely had time to react. One moment I was staring into his slate-colored eyes, and the next, his lips were pressed to mine.
I felt that familiar sense of surety melt through me as my body sang with sudden heat and my heart jumped into a skittery dance. Then, just as suddenly, he stepped back. He looked as surprised as I felt.
"I didn't mean,"
he said. At that moment, we heard footsteps, and Ivan rounded the corner. He bowed to the darkling and then to me, but I caught a little smirk playing on his lips.
"The apparatus getting impatient," he said. "One of his less appealing traits," replied the darkling smoothly.
The look of surprise had vanished from his face. He bowed to me, completely composed, and without another glance, he and Ivan left me standing in the snow. I stood there for a long moment, and then made my way back to the little palace in a daze. What just happened? I touched my fingers to my lips. Did the darkling really just kiss me? I avoided the domed hall and went straight to my room, but once I was there, I didn't know what to do with myself. I rang for a dinner tray and then sat picking at my food. I was desperate to talk to Jenya, but she slept at the Grand Palace every night, and I didn't have the courage to go try to find her. Finally, I gave up and decided to go down to the domed hall after all. Marie and Nadia had returned from their sleighing excursion and were sitting by the fire drinking tea. I was shocked to see Sergei sitting next to Marie, his arm looped through hers. "Maybe there's something in the air," I thought in amazement. I sat sipping tea with them, asking about their day and their trip to the countryside, but I had trouble keeping my mind on the conversation. My thoughts kept wandering back to the feel of the darkling's lips on mine, and the way he'd looked standing in the lamplight, his breath a white cloud in the cold night air, that stunned expression on his face. I knew I wouldn't be able to sleep, so when Marie suggested going to the banya, I decided to join them. Anna Kuya had always told us that the banya was barbaric, an excuse for peasants to drink kvass and engage in wanton behavior. But I was beginning to realize that old Anna had been a bit of a snob. I sat in the steam for as long as I could bear the heat, and then plunged squealing into the snow with the others, before running back inside to do it all over again. I stayed until long past midnight, laughing and gasping, trying to clear my head. When I stumbled back to my room, I fell into bed, my skin damp and pink, my hair in wet tangles. I felt flushed and boneless, but my mind was still worrying. I focused and summoned a warm wash of sunlight, making it dance in slivers across the painted ceiling, letting the sure rush of power soothe my nerves. Then the memory of the darkling's kiss blew through me and rattled my concentration, scattering my thoughts and making my heart swoop and dive like a bird borne aloft by uncertain currents. The light shattered, leaving me in darkness.
Chapter 14. As winter drew to a close, talk turned to the king and queen's fate at the Grand Palace. The Grisha summoners were expected to put on a demonstration of their powers to entertain the nobles, and much time was spent discussing who would perform and what would make the most impressive showing.
"Just don't call it performing," Jenya warned. "The darkling can't stand it. He thinks the winter fate is a giant waste of Grisha time."
I thought he might have a point. The Materialkai workshops buzzed morning and night with orders from the palace for cloth and gems and fireworks. The summoners spent hours at the stone pavilions honing their demonstrations. Given that Ravka was at war and had been for over 100 years, it all seemed a little frivolous. Still, I hadn't been to many parties, and it was hard not to get caught up in the talk of silks and dances and flowers. Bagra had no patience with me. If I lost focus, for even a moment, she'd smack me with her stick and say, "Dreaming of dancing with your dark prince!" I ignored her, but too often she was right. Despite my best efforts, I was thinking of the darkling. He'd disappeared once again, and Jenya told me that he'd left for the north. The other Grisha speculated that he would have to put in an appearance at the winter fete, but no one could be sure. Again and again, I found myself on the verge of telling Jenya about the kiss, but I always stopped just as the words were on my lips. "You're being ridiculous," I told myself sternly. "It didn't mean anything. He probably kisses a lot of Grisha girls.
And why would the Darkling have any interest in you when there are people like Jinya and Zoya around? But if all those things were true, I didn't want to know. As long as I kept my mouth shut, the kiss was a secret that the Darkling and I shared. And I wanted it to stay that way. All the same, some days it took everything in me not to stand up in the middle of breakfast and shout, "The Darkling kissed me!" If Bagra was disappointed in me, it was nothing compared to my disappointment in myself. As hard as I pushed, my limitations were becoming obvious. At the end of every lesson, I kept hearing the Darkling say, "It's not enough," and I knew he was right. He wanted me to destroy the very fabric of the Fold, to turn back the black tide of the Unsee, and I simply wasn't strong enough to manage that. I'd read enough to understand that this was the way of things. All Grisha had limits to their power, even the Darkling. But he'd said I was going to change the world, and it was hard to accept that I might not be up to the task. The Darkling had vanished, but the apparat seemed to be everywhere. He lurked in hallways and by the path to the lake. I thought he might be trying to trap me alone again, but I didn't want to listen to him rant about faith and suffering. I was careful never to let him catch me by myself. On the day of the Winter Fete, I was excused from my classes, but I went to see Bodkin anyway. I was too anxious about my part in the demonstration and the prospect of seeing the Darkling again to just sit in my room. Being around the other Grisha didn't help. Marie and Nadia talked constantly about their new silk kefta and what jewels they intended to wear. And David and the other fabricators kept accosting me to talk over the details of the demonstration. So I avoided the domed hall and went out to the training rooms by the stables. Bodkin put me through my paces and made me drill using my mirrors. Without them, I was still pretty helpless against him, but with my gloves on, I could almost hold my own. Or so I thought. When the lesson was over, Bodkin admitted that he'd been pulling his punches.
"Should not hit girl in face when she is going to party," he said with a shrug. "Bodkin will be fairer tomorrow."
I groaned at the prospect. I had a quick dinner in the domed hall, and then before anyone could corner me, I hurried up to my room, already thinking of my beautiful sunken tub. The banya was fun, but I'd had my share of communal bathing in the army, and privacy was still a novelty to me. When I'd had a long, luxurious soak, I sat by the windows to dry my hair and watch night fall over the lake. Soon the lamps lining the long drive to the palace would be lit, as nobles arrived in their lavish coaches, each more ornate than the last. I felt a little prickle of excitement. A few months ago, I would have dreaded a night like this, a performance, playing dress-up with hundreds of beautiful people in their beautiful clothes. I was still nervous, but I thought it all might actually be fun. I looked at the little clock on the mantel and frowned. A servant was supposed to be delivering my new silk kefta, but if she didn't arrive soon, I was going to have to wear my old wool one or borrow something from Marie. Almost as soon as I'd had the thought, a knock sounded at the door. But it was Jinya, her tall frame swathed in cream silk heavily embroidered in gold, her red hair piled high on her head to better display the massive diamonds dangling from her ears and the graceful turn of her neck. "Well," she said, turning this way and that. "I loathe you," I said with a smile. "I do look remarkable," she said, admiring herself in the mirror over the basin.
"You'd look even better with a little humility."
"I doubt that. Why aren't you dressed?" she asked, taking a break from marveling at her own reflection to notice I was still in my robe.
"My kefta hasn't arrived."
"Oh, well, the fabricators have been a bit overwhelmed with the queen's requests. I'm sure it will get here. Now, sit down in front of the mirror so I can do your hair." I practically squealed with excitement, but I managed to restrain myself. I'd been hoping Jinya would offer to do my hair, but I hadn't wanted to ask. "I thought you would be helping the queen," I said, as Jinya set her clever hands to work. She rolled her amber eyes. "I can only do so much.
Her Highness has decided that she doesn't feel up to attending the ball tonight. She has a headache.
Ha! I'm the one who spent an hour removing her crow's feet.
So, she's not going?
Of course she's going.